It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Capital Thinking. Hope you've had a good week so far. We've got another great show for you today. We're going to spend the first half of hour talking to one of the sharpest political observers here in Washington. That's Dave Leventhal, who's a reporter with Politico. If you don't read him and know what's going on in Politico, I suggest that you do that. Dave's had a terrific career before joining Politico. He worked for OpenSecrets.org at the Center of Responsive Politics. And he's, again, one of the crack reporters here in Washington. Most importantly, Dave, like me, is a graduate of Syracuse University, the number one basketball team in all the land, and was formerly an editor with the Daily Orange newspaper there. So, Dave, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. We're going to spend about half an hour talking about all things political, particularly the 2012 election. And I start by asking you to give us, 48 hours later, sort of the dust has settled. What does the New Hampshire primary mean?
Well, first, it's my pleasure to be with you, Kevin, and it's sure been a heck of a 48 hours. Mitt Romney was expected to win. Mitt Romney won. Mitt Romney won big, and he's really going to South Carolina with everything that he needs to be successful in this race. He's got money. He's got momentum, and he really still has a divided field when it comes to conservative candidates. Conservatives have just not been able to coalesce around a single candidate. It's not Rick Santorum. It's not Newt Gingrich. Ron Paul certainly has his constituency, but there's sort of a built-in ceiling with him. He's going to have a difficult time cracking that, you know, 20-25% magic number of votes in any of these primaries or caucuses. And if you're not putting up big numbers, you're probably not going to win. So it's really Mitt's game right now. And unless he stumbles, unless he does something that's disastrous to this momentum that he has right now, he's looking pretty good going to South Carolina. And polls reflect this, too.
Yeah, you know, Dave, what I thought was interesting is we've typically historically seen a split between New Hampshire and Iowa sentiments. And, you know, New Hampshire has been a chance to be the comeback kid if you're Bill Clinton or if you're John McCain, to rebound from Iowa. And it seemed like with Romney basically fighting Santorum to a last-second draw in Iowa, it almost just made it easy for New Hampshire voters who had long had Romney in the lead to just sort of coalesce and say, yeah, that's our guy. There's no reason to look at everyone else.
Yeah, it's bizarre because New Hampshire is, and rightfully so, has sort of been this bastion of independence where they're going to go against what everyone else in the country is doing. Or if Iowa goes left, they're going to go right, or vice versa. And actually spent 2 years after I graduated from Syracuse up in New Hampshire covering politics there and got to see firsthand exactly, you know, how much people dig their politics there. It is sport and nothing more and nothing less there. They love it. Voter turnout is high. And as you alluded to, in 2008, they actually were the big spoiler for Mitt Romney. Romney thinking that, hey, I'm former governor of Massachusetts. I spend great amounts of time in New Hampshire. I got a great chance to win. And what happened? John McCain beat him. And then John McCain seized the momentum and, of course, went on to get the Republican nomination. So, yeah, New Hampshire really just was kind of, at least from the political drama standpoint, kind of a downer for a lot of people. Certainly not a downer for Mitt Romney or his supporters. It played the role that he had only wished that he could have had it play in 2008, the role of sending him off to South Carolina and Nevada and Florida with, again, all this momentum that he enjoys right now.
Yeah, let's talk about South Carolina, Dave. I think what's fascinating, a couple facts. One, I thought I had seen somewhere that basically anyone who's won Iowa and New Hampshire, it's been at least since 1972 that somebody's won both of those states but then not been the nominee. And I see sort of two conflicting media narratives coming out of New Hampshire this week. One is Romney's got this all sewed up and everybody else is now going through the motions. Alternatively, the Republican process is so backloaded that even though he's won these first two contests, of course these other people must continue on, and they've got outside help, so they might as well keep going. Are both those narratives right?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at statistics in New Hampshire on the Republican primary side going back decades, I believe the person who had done the worst in New Hampshire and who ultimately went on to win the Republican nomination, was back in the 60s, Barry Goldwater, and he got about 22% of the vote. So if you're John Huntsman, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and certainly Rick Perry, you're not only fighting against Mitt Romney, you're kind of fighting against history, and the odds are not all that good. Of course, none of them were able to crack the 20 percentage point mark in New Hampshire, and they're struggling mightily. Rick Perry barely got the, in fact, he didn't get 1% in New Hampshire. Of course, he did not contest the New Hampshire primary, but you know, it's not like you go on to become president or even your party's nominee if you're not doing well or having some measure of success in either Iowa or New Hampshire. So again, it just goes back to Mitt having the money, Mitt having the momentum, and looking pretty in South Carolina.
Yeah, I want to come back and talk about some of those other guys in a second. It sure seems like I saw a poll today out of Florida where you couldn't even find Perry. He was, there have been jokes about Huntsman being behind Stephen Colbert in South Carolina. I think, you know, Perry was behind Charlie Crist in the most recent Florida poll. That's saying something bad, I think. Talk to me, though, about the attraction of Ron Paul. I mean, I guess what's fascinating for me is he's finished second in both places. It seems like all of his supporters know that it's a quixotic bid, that they're voting for someone who, even by his own admission, doesn't see himself in the White House. What gives with these folks? What do we make of the Ron Paul candidacy and what it means for the GOP?
He appeals to a relatively small but incredibly passionate number of people who are looking either within the Republican Party or, in some cases, independents, libertarians, even a few Democrats, for somebody who espouses the kind of anti-interventionalist views that he does, some of the financial views that he does, certainly when he talks about the Fed and he talks about the economy. This is a very appealing message to people who are just not hearing that kind of stuff from a Romney or from any of the other candidates. So he is not your traditional standard bearer Republican by any measure, but he's definitely somebody who again does appeal to a certain population, and they love him. They think he's great. A lot of young people, of course, are getting behind him, and many political commentators have made the you've talked about how a 76-year-old congressman from Texas is somehow actually attracting more 20-somethings and 30-somethings, even teenagers, than any other candidate in the Republican field. So there's maybe a bit of irony to that, but it also speaks to the power of message. If you're somebody who is saying the kind of things and in living by example the kind of things that you're saying, then people are going to get behind you regardless of who you are.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that he has, given his age, he does seem to be sort of the candidate of choice amongst younger primary voters, and that runs contrary to the people that have sort of been the apple of younger voter eyes in prior primary seasons. Dave, let me ask you, one of the things I think that's very interesting about what's going on in the primary, especially in New Hampshire, now that we've shifted to South Carolina, is there seems to be a circular firing squad, these folks who seem to acknowledge, I may not have much of a chance to be the nominee, but I'm going to hit Romney as hard as I can on the economy and his time at Bain Consulting. I read one of your cheat sheets this morning. I forget if it was the Huddle or which it was, that was basically talking about a Democratic strategist saying, you know, Republicans seem to be running in the primary the sort of playbook Democrats might run against Romney in the general. So talk to me a little bit about that.
There's kind of two schools of thought here. Number one is that this is going to hurt Mitt Romney, all of this bickering and all of these negative advertisements and all the hemming and hawing from Newt Gingrich and various other ones who are basically vilifying Romney. Heck, Rick Perry's out calling Mitt Romney a vulture capitalist at every turn right now. So this perhaps is not a good thing at all for Romney. But the other school of thought is that this is going to toughen him up. This is going to make him a better candidate, a more prepared candidate, going into a general election against Barack Obama. You got to remember, back in 08, Barack Obama himself faced some very withering criticism from Hillary Clinton's camp and other Democrats who definitely did not want to see him be the eventual nominee. But lo and behold, he was the eventual nominee, and everyone got behind him, and bygones are bygones. So it really remains to be seen as to whether this is going to be a bad thing or a good thing for Romney. I think perhaps you have to think it might be more of a good thing in the end if it doesn't get too bitter, because, hey, can you remember what happened politically back in August, September? Well, you know, not a lot. I mean, all the action's happening today. So what's happening here in January or February is probably going to be long forgotten by most people when it comes to the summer, July, August, when all the nominating activity is taking place and we're really getting into the teeth of the general election.
That's a great place for us to stop and hit a commercial, Dave. I want to come back. We're going to talk about the general election, economic conditions, and the role of third parties. Folks, we'll be back in just a minute. You've got it here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are joined this afternoon by Dave Leventhal, an outstanding graduate of Syracuse University, my alma mater. Most importantly, a crack reporter for Politico. If you're not a subscriber to Politico Online and some of their daily morning briefings, if you're at all interested in the world of politics and policy, I encourage you to go out there and sign up for them at politico.com today. Dave, let me, one question I wanted to get in before we switch to sort of the national campaign, and that is the economy and how it impacts the primary and then how it impacts the general. It seems to me that Romney's greatest attribute has been people thinking he would be a faithful steward, sort of shepherding us through these tough economic times and helping the country rebound and grow. But President Obama is starting to get sort of some green shoots, if you will, in the economic news the last couple of months that may blunt some of Romney's sort of key attribute.
You see, it's a great point here because Mitt Romney has really staked so much of his campaign on the economy and how he can be a good steward of it, how he is the person with the business acumen to go forward and do a great job with the economy, much better than Barack Obama has done, in his opinion. But you got to consider that if the jobless rate in the United States goes down, if the economy strengthens, if the stock market is up, all the factors that are constantly measured to test the temperature of the economy, if they're all going in a positive direction, then of course that is going to totally cut Barack Obama's way and be something that he can use on the campaign, is sort of the ultimate weapon against Republicans, in at least in his mind, the ultimate proof that his policies over the past 3 years have worked, and that his line that he inherited a terrible economy and he's doing everything that he can to not cause it to sink more and to right the ship, that all is working. So for Romney, it's going to be very curious to see if things do get better, how he's going to be able to change, how he's going to be able to pivot and really amend his message to make it resonate with people, sort of like it is today with the economy still floundering the way that it is.
Yep. Interesting. Well, Dave, when I go to the front page of Politico today, I read this morning, there's an article there about three billionaires will drag out the race.
Name the Durbin
and,
Act.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of super PACs and some of these people who are funding them and how they're able to keep candidates afloat, even though folks have done horribly in Iowa and New Hampshire who otherwise might have gotten out by now.
Super PACs, you cannot understate the role that they have played in this presidential election. And you have to remember that this is the first presidential election when super PACs have actually been part of the game. They're brand new, well, at least brand new for presidential politics. And just the 22nd super PAC primer here is that there are independent committees that can raise and spend unlimited sums of money to advocate for or against presidential candidates or congressional candidates, for that matter. And there were a couple of Supreme Court and federal court decisions back in 2010 that really changed the campaign finance landscape to allow them to take corporate and union and special interest money to fuel their efforts, in addition to money from individuals. But to speak to the point of people who are able to give extreme amounts of money to these super PACs, absolutely. There's three in particular that my colleague Ken Vogel wrote about today, talking about three super PACs that are supporting Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, and John Huntsman, respectively. And they're funded largely, so far as we can tell, by three billionaires, including John Huntsman Sr., John Huntsman's father, for the super PAC called Our Destiny PAC that's supporting John Huntsman. So it's really entirely different than anything that we've seen, and they have been major factors. Buddy Romer, another political presidential candidate, former governor of Louisiana, who's kind of running a quixotic shoestring campaign, told us just a couple of days ago that he thinks that if it wasn't for the super PAC, that John Huntsman would have dropped out of the race a long time ago, that he effectively would have had no campaign at all, and a third-place finish would have been ridiculous. He only finished as well as he did as a result of his super PAC, and there's probably some truth to that because his super PAC spent several million dollars in New Hampshire fighting for John Huntsman and in really giving him the kind of money that he could not raise himself.
It, Dave, like you, I'm on an awful lot of email distribution lists for these campaigns, and the Buddy Romer emails might be amongst the most amusing of the election cycle. I sure hope he doesn't get out too fast.
Well, he's really running his campaign for one big reason, and that's to address the issue of campaign finance reform. Now he has about a 1 in billion chance of actually being a factor in the presidential race in terms of the nominating procedures, but this is one issue that he's been harping on ever since he's gotten into the race, and he sure feels pretty lousy about the way that the super PACs have been operating in the presidential race, and doesn't speak very highly of the way that the situation is playing out.
Well, let's stick with this issue of money in politics. That's really your beat at Politico, one of the areas you have some expertise. You reported on some eye-popping numbers out of the Obama administration, and there, you know, Obama for America reelection. Romney's reported some pretty terrific numbers. Talk to us about how expensive you think the primary season will be, how expensive you think the general will be, and how much these third-party groups might spend.
Well, in speaking to the primary first, largely it's going to depend on how long the primary goes on the Republican side. If this is something that is, in fact, drawn out to Super Tuesday. If Romney does not do well in South Carolina and some of his competitors taste blood going forward to Nevada and Florida and on to Super Tuesday, then we could be looking at a heck of a lot more spending than we would have otherwise. If Romney wraps this up early, then the spending, of course, is going to wane, and you're not going to have nearly the type of money being thrown around that we've seen over the first two contests and into South Carolina. As it speaks to the general election, Barack Obama is the king of fundraising, period, end of sentence. He has raised more money than any other presidential candidate in U.S. history, and that came in 2008 when he raised about $750 million, spending effectively the same amount. So he could be looking during the general election and in through this entire presidential contest at raising in the ballpark of the amount that he did in 2008, and perhaps even more. We're easily talking about overall a $1 billion election for the presidency alone. And when you wrap in all the congressional contests going on too, this is something that is easily into the billions and billions of dollars, a heck of a lot of money when it comes down to it.
Yeah, I'd seen, I think he raised $220 million through the end of the year, blowing through their estimate that they would get to $200 million, and it's interesting to think about what you can do with that, especially without a contested primary. He's busy building infrastructure in early states, and meanwhile, you were saying, you know, if Romney wraps this up early, that curtails some of the Republican fundraising, and I know it certainly disappoints the ad salesmen at television stations in Florida and other critical primary states in March and April.
Yeah, they're probably rooting for this to go on as long as it possibly can, but that does speak to the issue of super PACs, now that they have the ability to raise unlimited amounts of money and, of course, spend unlimited sums of money, then it really gives the candidates a whole new vein of support that they've just never enjoyed before and can't do themselves, because candidates themselves cannot raise unlimited sums of money. They are limited to raising $2,500 per person per election, and you can do that in the primary, and then again in the general, a little bit more from political action committees, it jumps up to $5,000, but you just can't sit around and cut a $1 million check to a presidential candidate. You can, however, cut a $1 million check to a super PAC that is supportive of a yeah. presidential candidate. So there's the big difference right there, and it really gives people who are extremely wealthy the ability to have a greater influence, a much more outsized influence in a presidential contest, or again, another congressional contest, federal contest, than they did before.
What's funny here, Dave, is I remember a time, but 4 years ago, that Barack Obama was the king of campaign finance reform, and then he broke his promise to abide by the public financing limits because he realized he could raise an unlimited amount. I don't hear him talking much. He doesn't take lobbyist money, although his folks seem to have a couple quick end runs around that for both the convention and for his personal fundraising for reelection. So where is campaign finance sort of gone in the Obama administration rank of priorities here?
After the seminal Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission decision at the Supreme Court level back in 2010, which really kind of ushered in the era of unlimited money for direct advocacy for and against candidates at the federal level or state and local level too, Barack Obama was talking about this issue time and time again. You might remember that during a major speech before Congress with the Supreme Court during the State of the Union, sitting right in front of him, he raised this issue and blamed the Supreme Court for ushering in this era and you know, created a whole firestorm over that. This was a major, major issue that he was focusing on, and now he never speaks about it,
yep.
at least barely. And it's been a major, major about face from where he was and talking about this issue all the time, largely because he's been a great beneficiary of it, for better or for worse. He's been able to raise incredible amounts of money, of course, in his campaign, but also he has super PACs and politically active not-for-profit groups that are supportive of him. There's one in particular, Priorities USA, that has been run by two of his former staffers, Bill Burton and Sean Sweeney. So they're playing by the rules the way that they are written. And they're doing effectively what you would have to do, I guess, in any political climate, is be competitive with the opposition. Got to recall that the Republicans during the midterm were much more quick to the punch than the Democrats in adapting to this new campaign finance landscape. So Obama's just doing, I guess, what you would expect him to do, but it's a very, very stark and dramatic contrast with how he speaks about these issues today compared to where he was in the aftermath of the Citizens United decision.
Yeah, time for one last question on that point, Dave, and that is, it seems to me, that what's happened the last 4 years sort of kills the idea of public financing for elections, and the role the third parties are now playing really raises the specter that what folks would be more comfortable with would be unlimited contributions directly to the candidates, so at least you had some disclosure and accountability rather than these shadow contributions that are hard to track and understand to these third party groups who are not accountable to anybody.
This is something that's being talked about a lot now. Even Mitt Romney was saying, hey, I think super PACs are terrible. They're a disaster. But yet, what I would like to do, what Mitt Romney would like to do, speaking as him, is create just a system that you described where corporations or unions or individuals could donate as much money as they possibly would want to a candidate, him or herself. And we would effectively get rid of the super PACs, get rid of the outside groups, at least insofar as their role as sort of, quasi-unlimited contribution campaigns are concerned. So there's all different schools of thought here and philosophies as to how that would actually look in reality. But this is something that a lot of people, both on the right and the left, are talking about in sort of the vein of what can we do about super PACs, which a lot of folks, both Republican and Democrat, are not very keen on, even if they're using them and kind of biting the bullet and doing it against their better thoughts on the matter.
Dave, we'll have to let things go there. We'll have you back sometime soon. We'll be back with more Capital Thinking in just a moment.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. We are joined now by Stan Collender, one of our frequent guests. He's a partner at Corvus Communications, someone who has extensive experience in Washington dealing with all things related to the federal budget. Stan, welcome back to the show. I know I want to get you to mention later the revamping of your blog. I want to have you talk a little bit about that. But I want to start by asking you to give us your general outlook on the federal budget for 2012 and where you think things are headed if the economy heads up or if the economy remains stagnant.
Let's start with the basic numbers. I'm expecting the deficit to go down from about $1.3 trillion this year to below $1 trillion next year. Well, that is the current year. That is fiscal 2012. That would be a 30% improvement. So that's not nothing to sneeze at, but it still leaves a deficit close to $1 trillion. And while there'll be lots of discussion about it, actually discussion being a polite way for saying there's going to be a lot of screaming and yelling, I'm not really expecting anything new to happen on the budget until after the election, until a lame duck session. I don't see how Congress is going to agree to anything the president proposes or that the president will be able to agree politically anything that Congress proposes. So essentially any improvement in the economy is the only thing that's going to drive the deficit down further. And if the economy doesn't perform as well as expected, it'll go up. But I think a deficit somewhere between $900 billion and $1 trillion, you know, is about what we should expect for 2012. So that's a significant change, but still leaves a deficit to be dealt with.
Well, Stan, let's talk about the debt ceiling. The president made a move right at the end of the calendar year to ask for an extension to a little bit more than almost, I think, $16.4 trillion. And Congress basically has a right of refusal, right? Can you walk us through the mechanics of this extension of the debt ceiling and what you think is going to play out in both chambers and with the White House?
Sure. Let's just talk about the process, the way it's supposed to work. This was part of the deal that they put in place in August. This is the same deal that led to the formation of the anything but super committee that failed to come up with a deficit reduction plan. But the basic reason for that deal was that they had to raise the debt ceiling. They did it in three tranches. The first was an immediate increase of $400 billion. That was literally agreed upon as the president signed the legislation. The second was another $400 billion that was essentially agreed upon back in September. And then this additional request anticipated in that August budget deal, known as the Budget Control Act, the president requests up to $1.2 trillion in additional borrowing authority. And Congress can, if it wishes, move to disapprove it. That is, it's automatically approved unless Congress passes legislation within a specific time period to disapprove it. But there's virtually no chance of disapproval because the way it would have to work is the House would have to pass it, which is probably a certainty. The Senate would then have to pass it, which is very unlikely given the Democratic majority. And even if both houses of Congress pass this this motion for disapproval, the president could then veto it, and then Congress, both houses of Congress, would require a two-thirds vote to override. There's not a two-thirds vote to override a bill declaring this month January, let alone something as controversial as debt ceiling. So anybody who's worried about the credit of the United States or whether auctions are going to be going on as planned of Treasury bills, bonds, and notes, don't be. I mean, this is a political exercise. The debt ceiling will be increased as the president requested and was anticipated back in August. This is a non-event other than politics.
It's kabuki theater, right?
Kabuki is a step up from what it actually is.
Well, let me talk to you a little bit so we manage to avoid any of the difficult topics in the debt ceiling negotiations, the super committee process this year. We kicked the can down the road, whatever analogy you want. We still have lots of sort of big-ticket items out there in order to close the deficit, reduce spending, and bring the budget a little closer to balance. Talk to me about some of what you think might happen on those big-ticket items, if anything, in 2012, and also what you see some of the key stakeholders who care so much about those items. What will they be doing to interact with the White House and Congress this year?
Well, let's start with the basics. Again, let me repeat that I don't expect much of anything to happen until after the election. That is in a lame duck session somewhere in November or December. Between now and the election in November, there are actually very few opportunities for hostage taking on budget issues. The big one coming up is the payroll tax extension that now needs to be done by the end of February. Otherwise, payroll taxes will go up. I expect it to be a big, big fight, but ultimately the payroll tax cut will be extended yet again, probably through the end of the year. That means that there really won't be much big fighting until we get to September 30. That's when fiscal 2012 begins and 2013 ends. Starts. 2013 starts. So what you've got here is a situation where a month before the elections will be the next chance for a government shutdown. I find it hard to believe that it will come to that. That is, a month before the election, Republicans in the House in particular would try to force that issue, given especially what happened on the payroll tax fight this past time. But then the big ticket issues really come up, the big ticket items, as you called it. That is, the Bush-Obama tax cuts expired December 31st, 2012. Now, that's before the next Congress gets sworn in, is before the president takes the oath of office, whoever that might be. But it's December 31st, 2012. 2 days later, $1.2 trillion in spending cuts are supposed to start going into effect. That is January 2nd, 2013. These are the cuts that were triggered when the super committee failed. The so-called sequester. So in the space of 2 days, you could have some monumental changes in the deficit outlook. If the tax cuts aren't extended for anybody, and if these spending cuts go into effect, the projected deficit for 2012-2013 will fall to about $600 billion, and that's the point at which most economists would say, you know what, it, as a percentage of GDP, it's not a big deal. Let me tell you what I actually think is going to happen. I think that spending, that tax cut will be extended for, let's say, 6 months till June 30, and those spending cuts, the sequester, will be delayed until June 30, and so that the big fight will happen a year and a half from now and not at the end of the year.
Interesting. A year and a half from now, when, of course, we'll have at least a new Congress and perhaps a new occupant of the White House. So tell me a little bit about the politics on both sides of the political fence here and what each party will try and do in the budgetary gamesmanship to spin this in their direction for the election.
Yeah. Well, the big thing here is not so much, first of all, not to give the other side a victory. That is, Republicans don't want the president to be able to say that he succeeded in getting the GOP to back down on taxes and increase taxes. The Democrats don't want to be able to say that they knuckled under the GOP pressure on Medicare and Social Security. So the basic thing that's going to happen, the big politics of this year, is who can you blame for what isn't happening? You know, who can you blame for the stalemate? That's what's going to be going on. You've got the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party will be pushing every way they possibly can to prevent anything having to do with tax increases. Period. End of statement. That's all there is to it. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party will be fighting tooth and nail to prevent anything, any changes at all in Medicare and Social Security. And then in the midst of all that, you've got the defense community that will be fighting to prevent, delay, or mitigate the cuts, the big cuts in defense that would occur under the sequester. So essentially, the politics of this year is preventing things from happening, not pushing for anything big. And so groups like the Concord Coalition or the Committee for Responsible Budget or the Deficit Hawks will have very, very, very little room to maneuver this year, and probably very few people willing to listen to them.
Stan, you're always a little bit pessimistic about anything getting done. Tell me any sort of sliver of hope you see this year. I imagine that the House will at least get a budget resolution. Do you think the Senate will even make much of an attempt to get a budget resolution this year after a couple years of not making much progress there?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The House will almost certainly be able to pass a budget resolution because budget resolutions don't do anything. They just promise to do something in the future. So it's easy to pass to vote for something symbolic that would, if implemented, cut Medicare or something like that, for example, and then not actually do the implementation legislation. I think if you're looking for action on the budget, the only way this is going to happen this year, that is 2012, is if there's an economic catastrophe of some kind that allows everybody to move from their established positions, that allows Democrats to, you know, vote for spending cuts they wouldn't otherwise vote for, and Republicans to vote for tax increases for the good of the country. But it's hard to see where that kind of catastrophe would come from, or that it could be any worse than what we've seen in the last couple of years in Europe and, of course, within the United States. Short of that, the question to ask is, is there going to be any movement in the on legislation that might help the economy over the next year? And the answer probably is not, is no on that as well. So essentially, the economy is on its own. Don't expect anything from Washington because it's just too much of a stalemate. I got to tell you, the one most interesting thing about this, from my perspective, is that right after the 2010 election, Wall Street was applauding, saying stalemate is great. It was great when we had a stalemate in 95 and 96 between Gingrich and Clinton. We want it again. Well, they got it again, and now there's a lot of complaints on Wall Street that Washington's just not paying any attention.
Well,
interesting change.
Wall Street, like many people in a relationship, always wants what they can't have or don't currently have, right?
Or want to think back to a much nicer time.
That's right. That's right. The golden age of the past. Well, we've been joined by Stan Colander from Corvus. Stan, hit us with the info on your new website before we wrap up.
Well, it's still called CapitalGainsAndGames.com. CapitalGainsAndGames.com. It's now just called Stan Colander's Capital Gains and Games. It's now my own blog as opposed to my sharing it with three other people. And I did that because I thought that I had a voice, that sole voice, that could make a difference on budget and fiscal policy and Wall Street issues. It's still CapitalGainsAndGames.com, and I really appreciate your asking.
All right. Well, we appreciate having you on. We'll have you back soon to talk about the budget process. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
If you are looking for both an inside and insightful look at what you're not seeing in media coverage of today's legal, business, and policy battles, tune into In the Court of Public Opinion with host Jim Haggerty. What happens in the public arena affects us all. Whether you're following the latest high-profile court case, corporate crisis, or are just interested in government and policy, be sure to tune in every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. The witnesses are ready and the jury seated. So join us for our next session in the Court of Public Opinion.
How can we Americans realize our dreams to earn a living? How can you pursue your dream and make money as an owner or an employee? Learn how at The American Business Person, the online weekly radio talk show hosted by Rich Killian. Today's business leaders share how to succeed and what fails. If you own a new or established business or ever hope to, you must tune in. Join us every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Central, and noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel, or listen on demand to our archived shows.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back. We are joined now by Mark Ellison, a colleague of mine in the technology practice at Patton Boggs, and we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the high-tech industry right now. Mark has a great deal of experience there advising technology, communications, and utilities clients on a broad array of legal, regulatory, and business issues. Mark, welcome back to the show, and I want to start by asking you about this new system of Internet domain names that is just now getting started up. I already don't own KevinO'Neill.com. It sounds like I need to go out and get some new domain names before somebody grabs them up. Tell us about what's going on.
Well, Kevin, it's a whole new regime that's starting. The application process begins this month on January 12th. And it's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, also known as ICANN, that is going to start accepting applications for new, what are called generic top-level domain names. Everybody's familiar with .com and .org and .edu, which is, you know, the group of numbers and a few nation-specific top-level domains, such as .ca for Canada. But what's going to happen over the next 4 months is you're going to be able to apply for, instead of KevinO'Neill.com, you could apply for .KevinO'Neill, or Ford can apply for .Ford, or somebody can apply for .shoes or .golf. It's really going to be an unlimited world in terms of what name you want to have after that .. So there's going to be a bit of a land rush, although there's a lot of cost involved in this, and it's not an easy hoop to jump through.
Interesting. I know, you know, one of the things I had read about, Mark, over the last few weeks was that companies are sort of getting out there, and organizations are sort of staking their presence. I had read that Penn State had actually gone out and bought a couple of domain names related to the scandal, the child abuse scandal there, because they were afraid that these new domains would allow somebody to buy those sites and criticize them. So tell me about what corporations and organizations are sort of doing to adjust to this new sort of land grab. It's like the Oklahoma land grab of the Internet.
Well, I think they're doing two things. In some cases, they're going to be filing for their own names. As I said, I think somebody that's like a .Ford or a .Chevrolet, you know, they may apply for their own names, or they, you know, somebody may apply for .cars. So I think there's going to be approached from two angles. One is, do I want to have my own name as my domain name? So that's question number one. Question number two is, if I don't file for that, do I have to be watching to be assured that somebody else doesn't apply for .Ford or .General Motors or whatever? And the answer is yes, of course you do. So there will be a big process of making sure that people are not name squatting and holding names hostage. There is a significant cost involved. It's about it's a 300-page application, or rules, with a very significant part of that being the application. So there's a significant cost up front of probably $50,000 to $100,000 for the application preparation. And then there's an application fee with ICANN of $185,000. And then once the name is granted, because it is a unique top-level domain name, the company will have to do its own registry and supporting of that name, so that everything that they do, that they, you know, the lower level domain names that they want to put with that, they would control through their own registries, and that's not an inexpensive process. So it's not going to be for anybody, but I think major corporations, associations, trade groups, and certainly certain areas of products. You know, dot drugs, dot shoes, that type of thing, may want to secure their own names and have their own registries.
That's very interesting, Mark. Now, I know there were some recent congressional hearings on this subject in the late fall. Tell me a little bit about what the congressional concerns are about how this process is playing out.
Well, I think the concerns are coming from U.S. corporations that are afraid that they're going to have to make this investment of time and money to either secure their own names or be very active in monitoring the process so that no one attacks their own names. I think there's also concern from law enforcement and other other agencies about their ability to track the use of names if the registries are private. So there have been a couple of hearings recently on the Hill. As a matter of fact, today, Senator Rockefeller, who chairs the Commerce Committee on the Senate side, sent a letter to ICANN asking them to stall and hold off on the process. But what we're understanding, th- this this process has gone on and been in the planning works for a number of years, and they do not want to stall this process at this time. There are a great many companies worldwide and even countries that will begin to have their own top-level domain name that have invested a lot of time and money in this process already. So I think it's going to move forward, although there is pressure from the U.S. For it to be delayed. I'll be surprised if it is delayed. I think it's going to start on January 12th. And that window, by the way, is open until April 12th for anyone who wants to file. And certainly anybody that is out there that is concerned about if they have a corporate name, whether it's Coca-Cola, Coke, Kleenex, whatever it may be, they're going to want to either file for themselves or at least be assured that nobody else is grabbing that name and sitting on it. And in terms of protecting your own name, we don't know what the cost of that is going to be right now, but based on past experience, we don't think that will be a very expensive process.
All right, so it won't be like the $100,000 that you mentioned for some of these other things.
But it won't be in that range.
Talk to me a little bit more about what companies can do to protect themselves from interlopers or squatters that are trying to grab a name or a brand and hold it hostage going forward on this this new territory.
Well, there's a couple of different ways you can do it. One, of course, would be to file for yourself. I mean, again, if you're Kimberly-Clark and you own Kleenex and you want to protect Kleenex, you can apply for .Kleenex, and presumably you'll get it because you're the holder of that trademark. You know, another way is to just file an objection, watching the registry as these applications come in, and filing objections to anybody that might try to file a claim for a name that is a trademark name. And then also they would have the normal rights of a trademark owner to go against an individual or a company that might secure an infringing name under your more standard trademark enforcement rights.
All right.
So there are several things to do, but certainly everybody needs to be aware of this and be watching this process as it moves forward if they've got a company or...
We're gonna wrap things up there. We've been joined by Mark Ellison talking about the new internet domain registration process. This week's Capital Thinking. We'll be back next week with more.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.